Anyway,
yeah.
So I'm speaking with Jake Ward, and Jake, you're playing an important part in the Deep Sea Wind Consortium's project.
Sure.
Can you tell me what your role is with that and a little bit about what Deep Sea Wind Consortium is now?
Well, Deep Sea Wind Consortium was a team of nonprofits, universities, and companies that was looking at, are still looking at, the evolution of floating platform wind technology and the potential for Gulf of Maine or anywhere else in the world. So our efforts are still ongoing. We have our DOE funding. We're still in the various stages of designing our scale models. In particular, we're looking at the buoyancy-based and tension-like platform models, because obviously Statoil has got a good activity going on around the spar. So we think that there's a need to look at all the technologies, because they'll be suitable in different places. And some of them will lend themselves to deeper water, some of them to shallower water, some standing in the right way.
Yeah. Let's go out in the hallway here, just because it's quieter.
Your boat, excuse me, Susan.
RSU-13.
Hey, sure. Okay, so gosh, I almost want to start again because this would sound
Okay.
I'm speaking with Jake Ward of Deep Sea Wind Consortium, and Deep Sea Wind Consortium is developing one of the world's first deep water floating wind power projects. And can you tell us a bit about the consortium?
So the consortium is primarily made up of folks like the University of Maine, other research institutions, Maine Maritime Academy, nonprofit organizations, as well as private sector companies like Bath Ironworks, Chimbro, the whole supply chain. And we're working on projects to evaluate the first phase of the projects were to evaluate the probability, feasibility of doing floating wind power in the Gulf of Maine. Did a very comprehensive look at all the resources in the Gulf. Our deep sea wind wind report that we put out a little over a year and a half ago. A comprehensive look at all the aspects of the Gulf of Maine, from the environmental resources, the wind resources, fishing, fouling, recreation, where the ports are, where the electrical grid is, all that information compiled so that we have the best information that we have available today of what the Gulf of Maine really looks like. And hopefully that will be used to inform people on where to locate, or could locate, or should locate, or shouldn't locate any potential floating platform resources. The next phase was developing some scale models of the three primary types of floating wind platform technology: buoyancy-based, semi-submersible, tension-like platform, and the spar. As you've seen from Highwind's presentation, they are doing the spar, so we're continuing to look at the tension-like platform as well as the semi-submersible designs.
Now, were those two designs types that you use these tiny scale models?
Correct. We did 1/50th scale modeling. We did it over in a wind wave tank over in the Amsterdam a year ago, and all that data was used to collect the data to help verify computer models. We used the computer models to help try to design larger scale, full scale models. So we're using that information, and we're in the process of designing some less than full scale with the intent to have something deployed in the university's test site probably in the next summer.
Now, we were all expecting that to take place this year, but it seems like the wheels of bureaucracy or something are grinding exceedingly slow.
Well, I think it's not to be unexpected in the R&D world, where you have the convergence of everything from design constraints, the information we learn, the cost of building prototypes, the funding sources in Washington, the permitting, the need to collect environmental data. I think that all of that has all come together to say that we didn't make the deadlines we wanted to make for this year, so we're working on next year. Because of the window of opportunity, we're trying to deploy in an offshore site smaller than full-scale models, so we need to pick the weather window where the the weather is scaled to what we a smaller scale version of what the worst case scenario would be. So it's not like if we got everything ready, we could go in December. That wouldn't be the best time. So, you know, it's sort of year to year because we're trying to get that weather window, which is sort of the June to October, June to August, September time frame.
Now, a consortium, as we know, is a mix of private companies, academic, and businesses, large and small, international, national, and so on. It sounds like quite a complicated web to keep moving all together there. Are you sort of a project manager? What is your role?
My role primarily has been education and outreach, and then supporting some of the permitting activities on the sort of the collection to make sure we have all the right data and the information is assembled right to keep our the different agencies up to speed and, you know, making sure we're complete application. The education outreach, I've done a lot of the workshops and seminars around the state, just, you know, letting people know what the project's all about and the progress that we're making and when we're making it. And so, you know, over the last couple of years, I've done numerous public presentations up and down the coast, out on Monhegan, just talking about what the project's all about.
And so what has been the reaction?
I think it's been very similar to some of the reaction you've seen around here, that we've had a lot of interest. Great, you know, support for the project. There's a lot of folks that have questions that we give you the best information we have today. But that's part of doing research and development, is getting more information. We have folks that are obviously concerned that it's going to impact their livelihood or their environment. And at the same time, we have folks that are very supportive because if we can create economic opportunity, whether it's anything from manufacturing pieces and parts on shore to installing offshore to operation maintenance to ongoing monitoring, all those different aspects are going to take people and jobs. So,
and people that are concerned about global warming that are saying reduce the carbon.
Yep. I mean, there's certainly a major part of all of this is, what are the best available sources of energy that we can use to support our economy? And, you know, there's, I'm not by any means a all wind and no gas and no any nuclear or anything else. It's what's the best balance, what's the best mix, and how do we take advantage of those resources that are there and hopefully create economic opportunity. We don't have oil and we don't have gas in the state of Maine naturally occurring. If we're importing fuel sources, are there better ways to create energy from our natural our pre-existing resources? And that's why as a university we have a fairly robust program in pulp and paper and bioproducts, and some of the things we're looking at are biofuels that are a byproduct of the pulp paper industry. We have some folks looking at different aspects of solar. Where do we have the opportunity to take advantage and support our economy in the best way it makes sense.
Now, it seems that you got editorial support pretty much from the major media of the state.
I would say over the past couple years there's been numerous editorial newspaper support stories that have supported the concept of doing the research.
Hey, how's it going?
That's what we're about. We're trying to find the right answers so we can make the best choices or inform the best choices. You know, Statoil will be making their decisions based on what makes sense for their whole environment, whether it's their corporate environment, their community environment. I mean, they think they're looking at all the same things.
Yeah. Now, earlier you'd mentioned, you know, that some of the reasons for the delay till next year was different permits. Were those state ones or federal?
We have the opportunity to in the state test site, we have the opportunity to do the permitting process that the state put forward, and we've certainly collected a lot of the data necessary to support that. At the same time, because of the Department of Energy funding, we have to follow the environmental EIS
the
NEPA process, correct, and get a and do an environmental assessment and all that activity. And as we've through some of the R&D processes changed some of the aspects of the design, you have to go back and redo some of those things. So I would say that I don't want to say that we don't have permits, because in some cases we haven't applied specifically for them yet as we evolve this, but we know the regulations that we have to comply with, and some of the guidance from our funding agencies on how to do that.
And Dr. Dagger on the radio recently said he felt it probably be getting those permits, you know, sometime this summer or fall, and that would allow you to take next spring as your launching date.
We are certainly hopeful that we'll have next spring as our launching date.
Yeah.
I still await to hear from some of our agency folks on what the next steps will be. I don't have conclusive dates at this point.
It must be a challenge just because businesses work at different speeds than academics, and you know, the engineering theoreticians versus the metallurgists, it's such a mixed bag. It must be hard to keep all that.
Well, that's the great part about research and development, when you're looking for commercialization. That's really the great mixing pot. I mean, it's yes, we have good basic scientists, and we're bringing great basic science to this. We have, we're in a regulatory, but I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, the regulations are there to protect the environment. We need to make sure that we meet all those conditions and constraints. And the economics of it all are what the business community really wants. So you've got a great blend here of trying to solve some fairly interesting problems in the real world environment. And so the trials and tribulations we're going through are not unexpected. It's just the fact of life.
Just growing pains of something new.
That's right.
Now,
the first one of anything is very hard, and the second and third one are very hard, but hopefully by the time we get to the 10th or 12th or 13th one, then we'll figure it out.
Now, Dr. Habib Dagher, in your engineering department, has been the leader of this. He seems to have a certain charisma or something that makes people really want to work with him. Can you tell me a bit about him?
Habib's a great guy. I mean, worked together for 20 plus years, and he's one of the smartest men I know, and he really has a great grasp of all the issues, and tries to bring them together and put them into a context that makes sense. And I think he's a great translator in that sense, that it's not all scientific gobbledygook, and he really has a great appreciation for the world we live in, and trying to make the world a better place, and at the same time understands all the real challenges to doing something financially, economically, in a business environment.
So he's he's able to, from his practical engineering standpoint, looking at things like bridge in a backpack, find an issue, figure out how to deal with it,
right,
and get it out there. Here too, he's, as you say, bringing together these disparate but all necessary things, and from his, he's able to kind of help weave it all together then.
I would say that's one of his skills, solutions oriented. Yeah.
I've never quite understood what the sort of corporate structure is of Deep Sea Wind. Is when they say a consortium, I think of this vast round table, that there are all these different interests.
Yeah, and I guess I would say that it's not much different than that. I mean, it's not a incorporated structure, a consortium of people who are interested in the same problem and bringing their perspective to that problem and potentially their solution. So it's not necessarily a exclusive, and it's it's fairly inclusive to people who want to be part of the solution. So that's why we call it a consortium.
Yeah. Were you surprised when Statoil started making noises about being interested in the Gulf of Maine?
Not at all. I think that we were, very interested in their approach, and were very instrumental in developing our deep sea wind report. And the wind report is something that they're using to help guide their process. They're certainly using a lot of that information as baseline information and figuring out where they need to collect additional information. I think it was very helpful in them making headway with some of the logistics, and certainly the shoreside supply chain, the ports, and all that kind of stuff. So I think we're very encouraged that they're, I think anybody who continues to be interested in the resource and doing it at the, you know, as they are doing in a very pragmatic R&D way, that's the right approach to exploring the potential of this industry and the sector.
And so what kind of interaction is there between the two organizations? Statoil, of course, as you said, you know, they have a great deal of experience from their North Sea gas and oil work. They, although I don't think there are any floating items there, who knows, but
I would suggest that they do have floating platforms in oil and gas. There is a wide variety of technologies used in the oil and gas industry, and most of the floating wind technology is trying to learn from that experience. I mean, there's decades of experience in offshore oil and gas with floating platforms. Some of the ones that the basic designs we're talking about, semi-submersible tension leg platform and spar designs, all originate in the offshore oil and gas. So there's a tremendous amount of experience.
Right now, are the deep sea wind and the high wind ones the only two floating deep sea projects?
No, I think there's a variety of companies around the country and around the world that are looking at different floating platform technologies. Principal Power, for example, has a fairly large scale deployment, I think, in Portugal, Puerto Rico. I'm not sure. I can't remember.
I think now you say it may be Portugal.
Portugal. And there's a variety of other companies. If you were to Google floating wind platforms, you'd see that there's a variety of companies who have different designs that they are hoping to deploy at scale or full scale. The attractiveness of the floating technology is certainly starting to emerge as the next evolution of offshore wind.
Must be as exciting as the first powered flight. Things were going. I mean, new technology. People had their kites and so on, but to actually move something forward ahead like this.
I think there are a lot of similarities to the introduction of new technologies and the trials and tribulations of getting that first, whether it's the Wright brothers flying an airplane to today's jetliners, you know, or the first folks to go up in a rocket to the space shuttle to now commercial flights going into space to things as simple as the automobile. I shouldn't say simple, but you know, we've made simple the automobile and the internet and all those other, you know, just about anything you can think of. The evolution of those technologies, which a lot of people didn't believe could happen when they first came out, and now we take advantage of every day without even thinking about it.
Well, that's kind of a reassuring thing in our world right now. There's an awful lot of trauma going on around the planet. It's good to know some people are still pushing the envelope on how to make things better, not simply how to fight each other.
I think that's what's great about the research environment and science and technology and people wanting to make life better for folks all over the world. I mean, you know, history is what it is, and hopefully we can continue forth.
Now, what made you decide, as an educational person, to become involved in the offshore wind education?
Well, my role at the university is research economic development. That's part of what I do for the university, is try to take the research and development assets that we have and help them support the economy. Mm-hmm. And so from all different aspects of that, I mean, the whole campus and that. So my training is engineering, so I'm used to problem solving. And so, but a big part of problem solving is making sure that you're customer base knows what your solutions are, and also if you have a better idea of what the problems are. So, I mean, that's what's, I sort of stepped into this because it's a perfect, it's a perfect blend of how do we find solutions if we don't really know what the problems are. And, sometimes the customer doesn't always know what they want, but they really know what their challenges are. So the famous quote from Henry Ford is something, if I'd asked my customer what they want, they would have said a faster horse. But when you ask the customer what their problems were, I need to get to my goods to market quicker. I need reliable transportation. You know, all the challenges that they were facing, the automobile ends up being a better solution than a horse. So part of this is listening to potential customers, whether they're citizens, whether they're students, whether they're folks who are looking for jobs, and really understanding what their challenges are, and saying, are any of these technology solutions to that?
And to then, to see if, basically it sounds like taking information and pushing the envelope as far as from existing technology
as,
to what you said.
As pragmatically as possible, yeah. Yep. I would say that.
Now, what got you involved in being, in this entire? Well, I mean, well, what am I trying to ask you here? Basically, once someone said, oh, "What's your major going to be?" And tell me a bit about your background. Then, what before you were?
Before I was what? Because I've been doing this a long time.
I
went to engineering school because that's what I was interested in. I grew up on the coast of Maine, so I was interested in the marine world. And I got a degree in mechanical engineering and a degree in ocean engineering. I came to work at the University of Maine to help work in economic development, help technology solve, basically in the tech-based world, how do we solve problems. So after about 20 years, this all comes together, and it's sort of a blend of everything that I'm happy about, I like. You know, like Maine, I like the marine environment, I like the future opportunity that jobs and that people can support Maine, and that there's economic opportunity here for Maine built into it. So it's a sort of a nice thing.
All right, well, thank you, Jake. I've been speaking with Jake Ward, Deep Sea Wind Consortium. And what is your specific role there within the consortium?
As I said, I'm working on some of the permitting aspects and then part of the education and outreach, stakeholder outreach.
Okay, it doesn't have a label, has
it? Nope, I don't.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Sure thing.